on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening today to the one-of-a-kind story of Adelano David. Or maybe if you run into him in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he lives now, you'd call him Al David. You have to call him a survivor. We're going to hear about some situations where the courage of others saved his life, including his escape from the infamous Bataan Death March. Born in the Philippines, Al joined the U.S. Army before America's involvement in World War II. He was serving with the 33rd Infantry Division, the 31st Regiment, and was sent to the Bataan Peninsula. We've heard about the pitiful state of their supplies and equipment. And before we left off, he talked about being ordered to surrender. He didn't want to, but he had no choice. Let's pick up the story there.
When we first surrendered, we were lined up. Anybody found with Japanese money, paper money, or anything, or a sword, or as a souvenir, or anything that has a Japanese marking, the owner, the soldier who had it, was usually beheaded or beaten up. On my own, they tried to take my watch and my military ring, and I objected. And when I objected, the soldier hit me with the butt of his rifle in the belly and on my shins. So I fell down on my knees, and I was so angry I was going to retaliate when I got up. But a buddy mine held me back. He said, "Don't, Al, it's going to kill you, because they've done that." And when we gathered together in groups of 100, sometimes groups of 50, to start us on the march. On the march, even before I got too far from the site of surrender, I saw already bodies on the road, bayoneted, and these are not soldiers who were fighting, but they were sick, too sick to go on, with malaria, dysentery. That's when I began to lose hope. I said, "Oh, I'm going to die." Then in the next town, if I have a chance, I'll die trying to escape or escape. And I did that.
So how far into the march was that? How many days?
One day. So when I escaped, at first what my buddies were trying to do was, because I could not stand up anymore, and they could not carry me anymore. I had malaria and dysentery and a shrapnel wound, and I was fainting. So he said, "The next chance we have, you better go." When we saw the Japanese away from the guarding us, I tried to escape through the bushes, but they suddenly jerked me back, and they said, "I'll wait for another chance." At this point, I decided to die marching, because I was scared for some reason or other. No, I got scared. When they saw a gap a few miles afterwards, they pushed me through the bushes, and I fell across the bushes into a trench dug out by the Filipino occupants of the house by the road. And they covered me with banana leaves and bamboo leaves.
So you get pushed by your friends, who've already saved your life a couple times, it sounds like, by holding you back from retaliating and then telling you not to escape then. They push you into the bushes, you fall into this trench, and you're so weak you don't even know what to do, but these occupants of the house come down and cover you?
I was out for a while, because I was sick and thirsty and starving. When I woke up, I was already in the house, and they nursed me for 3 days. On the fourth day, I told them that I had to go, and they pointed me. They gave me a map where to join the rest of the group. Apparently, they had help other people. Many soldiers escaped through the same, so they knew where to go.
And, you know, there are so many great stories about the war in Europe, and we hear about, you know, the Corrie Ten Booms of the world and the Anne Frank situation, or Oscar Schindler, and these people that protected some of the Jews. And we don't hear so many stories about the Pacific, but really, these people risked their lives to save yours. How did that make you feel? How indebted did you feel to those folks?
Lifetime, but when I came back, I was back into the MacArthur Liberation Army. I looked for them, but they had moved away already. I know their last names, De La Cruz, but up to now I've not been able to contact them.
And it sounds like you've spent some time trying.
This is the same time I was looking for my sweetheart. and because they had gone to the hills and I didn't know where. So it took me a while to finally give up. So when I finally found where she was home in Manila.
And a lot happened in between there. And I know you have learned a lot over the years. You're involved in the Bataan Corregidor Survivors Group, and you've met a lot of other people who survived the march, and you know how many died on the march. Is there any question in your mind that if you hadn't escaped at that point, that you would have survived or not? What do you think would have happened?
I would have died on the way, because on the way there were cattle cars where we were going to be confined. It was a cow car where only 100 could be, and they were jam-packed. They could not even sit down. I probably would have died of starvation and thirst on the way, or malaria or dysentery, because it was from where I escaped, it was another 30 miles. And if I escaped the death march and got into the cattle car, car which was going to in the concentration camp, I would have died there also, because 100 people died in that in one car, just from all sicknesses and from lack of air.
So this is the first kind of real miraculous rescue that you experienced, and I know there were more to come, or more situations where you felt that way. But what did you do from there? Because this is still a pretty chaotic spot to be, I imagine. You don't know where it's safe to be. And how did you operate over those weeks and months that followed? What'd you do?
When I joined the underground, our first order was to raid garrisons. And also, and the next order is at midnight, stop trucks with supplies, food and ammunition to Japanese garrisons. After a few raids, we discovered that every time there were casualties in the raids on garrisons, 10 people in the barrios, in the villages, were chosen and executed, man, woman, or child, as long as they could get 10, in retaliation. So we stopped that. So we only started waiting for midnight for trucks to take their supplies and take prisoners. That lasted with me for about 2 months, when I got down with a severe case of malaria, and they sent me to... They smuggled me to Manila, where there was a underground spy ring under the guise of Food Administration. We, as Food Administration and the Japanese occupation, the government collaborated in inspecting, like the FDA here, food supplies and the markets, inspecting meat and everything. As such, we were able to, because we supplied the Japanese garrisons, we were able to get an idea how many tanks have arrived, how many airplanes have arrived. And we sent this information to somebody called High Pockets, who was the head of the spy ring in Manila. But cut a long story short, we were discovered, and I escaped again, barely, because I was going to report 9 o'clock to the, it was us in the Metropolitan Theater building, our cell was there, led by Colonel Sam Moran. And as I entered the compound to get my pay, as I entered the door, my wife's brother's brother-in-law was also an officer. He stopped me and said, "I'll get the hell out of here. The Japanese camp, I have just captured the management." So they captured 10 people, and I hightailed it out of there and went to back to my family, and because the family was with me now, because I was in Manila. And then in the underground newsletter in the next few weeks, I learned that our 10 top men in our cell were beheaded. They were told to dig their graves in the Chinese cemetery, which is not too far from my wife's house, and they beheaded them. And I only remember one name, Colonel Moran, and another name, Borja.
So that would have been your fate too?
Yeah. If I was not delayed, because I was delayed talking to my friend, because we were talking about black market, because we needed food supplies. We were looking for black market supplies to sell. And I was delayed a few minutes. If I was there in the meeting, I would have been there, me and the other guy.
Yet another close call. And you mentioned your wife. At this time, she's your sweetheart. You hadn't married yet, but then you said it was a while before you saw her again. What was that like when you got to see her? Because I'm sure she had no idea what had happened to you.
She was looking out her window, and she saw me coming, and she had a hunch that it was me. But the maid who opened the garage door, that's where we entered the house, didn't want to admit me because she didn't recognize me. I had long hair and a beard, and I was skin and bones, like somebody on a hanger. I was probably 100 pounds, 109 pounds, out of 153 pounds. So they didn't want to get me in until my wife came down. And, of course, you know, all of us, she didn't want to believe it was me because I didn't look like me. But right then and there, we began to plan on eloping because his father wanted to shoot me.
Yet another situation where you beat the odds, I suppose. And again, I think a lot of people just aren't aware of what was happening there in the Philippines because they think, well, America was chased out of there, the death march, MacArthur fled, he said, I shall return, and then he comes back to Lady all these years later. But they forget that there were things going on there the whole time, and you were involved in all of that. What kept you believing that your side could win, that this Japanese oppression was not going to be the rest of your life?
What we believed in was air cover and submarines. And I may realize now I'm a voracious reader and I do research, so I was more aware than my peers about the situation because I know that back in 1922, the Americans already gave up the Philippines to defend. So to be blunt, we were doomed since 1922 to fight a losing war. A lot of people like MacArthur, and a lot of people dislike him. But as I read more about MacArthur, I find that too much he has been discredited too much. He was in a fix, and he did what he could. When the papers were covered with the readiness of the Philippine Army, that was his bluff against the Japanese so that they won't attack sooner. He told the newspapers and Roosevelt that we were quite ready for the Japanese because of our heroism before in the war against Spain, war against America.
What can you share about the different things that you did over that time period? And what, in general, this underground army was able to accomplish in terms of the big picture and what eventually happened there in the Philippines. What are the things that you feel really proud about that you did and those other guys serving with you were able to do?
Number one, while the spying was operating, we were able to relate to Australia through a smuggled radio the compliments that came in, how many warships, how many airplanes, how many airfields, how many troops. We were able to impart this to Australia, which was related to MacArthur. And what I'm proud of is really that the Filipinos never surrendered to the luring of the Japanese to become one of them. We were too ingrained with American culture, and we considered the Japanese as second-class citizens to us. So we never really assimilated with them. But in fairness to them, they were not all demons. They were educated officers who took care of the sick and who took care of the... Even on the death march, there were Japanese soldiers who gave food to the starving. Stealthily, they gave food to soldiers who were about to fall. So they're not... Humanity is complex.
And you've told us about a couple of the what-if situations already, the close calls where it could have ended for you right there. And I'm glad it didn't because you're looking pretty good at 93. I know you have a book coming out in the next year about your experiences. What were some more of those situations over the rest of the war where you look back and say, boy, that was really close. That could have ended it for me right there.
One thing that really scared the hell out of me after I escaped on the beheading of my people in the spy ring, I was evacuating my family from the boondocks. I found a Ford wagon to transport my family. My family was my oldest brother was deaf mute. My two brothers, we had sacks of rice, and And I didn't know it was contraband. So we were stopped midway between where I took my family from the boondocks to Manila. We were stopped, and a soldier poked his knife, his bayonet, into the stock, and rice came out. So they tied my hands behind my back and took me to the camp. And there was a stump, a tree cut. And they laid my head on the block, and I prayed, and I was almost fainting. I knew this was the end.
But clearly it wasn't the end, or we wouldn't be hearing this story from 93-year-old Atilano David. And we'll find out how he got out of that one, plus find out how he came to work with legendary newsman Edward R. Murrow. All that and more when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.